1857-8, as money, china, silver, and other valuable objects had to be handed over for capital accumulation. The second took place in the summer of 1958 with the advent of the communes. A third wind blew away pots, pans, and iron utensils as the steel campaign gripped the county. Then, in March 1959, all savings in state banks were frozen. By the autumn of that year, large irrigation projects were launched again, and tools and timber were commandeered. Finally, in the spring of 1960, a project for a giant pigsty was hatched by a local leader who seized pigs and building materials. Most people had little recourse against open pillage, but they were not passive victims, and many devised a whole range of strategies of survival. The most common one was to slack at work, allowing natural inertia to take over. Loudspeakers might be blaring exhortations to work, propaganda posters might extol the model worker who overfulfilled the plan, but apathy more often than not governed the factory floor. In a typical workshop of 40 workers in Beijing, half a dozen would habitually crouch around the stove to warm up in winter, while others would leave the factory in daytime to queue for goods or watch a movie. Carders simply did not have the means to control every worker and punish every disciplinary breach. A more comprehensive study by the propaganda department showed that in Shanghai, up to half of all workers failed to pay much heed to work discipline. Some would arrive several hours late, others spent time chatting with each other. A few loafers failed to do any work at all, simply waiting for the next meal. Many disappeared well before the end of the day. The deeper the country sank into famine, the greater the shirking became. By 1961, each worker in Shanghai was contributing 40% less value than in 1959, as more workers managed to produce fewer goods. Slacking, of course, was only one of several reasons why productivity plummeted, as we have seen in Chapter 18. But by 1961, factory workers had become masters of time theft. In the countryside, by 1959, many villagers had to work all day without eating. Apathy at work, besides being a result of malnutrition, was essential for survival, as every bit of energy had to be saved to get through the day. Farmers would till the fields under the watchful eye of a passing carder, but as soon as he was out of sight, they would drop their tools and sit by the road, waiting for the end of their shift. In parts of the countryside, people slept all afternoon, placing their own sentries at key intersections along the fields. Where carders were lenient, up to half the local population managed to avoid work. In some villages, under a tolerant leadership, entire families would huddle together and sleep for days on end, literally hibernating through the winter months. Some historians have interpreted black marketeering, obstruction, slacking, and theft as acts of resistance or weapons of the weak, pitting peasants against the state. But these survival techniques pervaded the social spectrum, so much so that if these were acts of resistance, the party would already have collapsed. In the conditions of starvation created by the regime, many people had little choice but to ignore customary moral standards and steal as much as they could. Theft was endemic, its frequency determined by need and opportunity. Transportation workers were in the best position to pilfer state property as millions of tons of goods passed through their hands. In the Wuhan Harbor No. 6 dock, over 280 of the 1,200 employees systematically stripped freight trains while pretending to carry out maintenance and repair work. In Hohhot, Inner Mongolia, half of the 864 porters at the railway station stole goods. Mail theft was common, and was often organized by party members. In the Guangzhou post office, a team of four was responsible for opening more than 10,000 overseas parcels, taking watches, pens, ginseng, milk powder, dried abalone, and other gifts. Many of the stolen wares were then sold at auction to postal workers. The entire leadership at the post office, or more than 100 carders, had a hand in the operation. Students stole from the canteen, 50 cases a month being brought to light in Nanjing University in 1960. In Hushu Middle School in Xianning County, just outside Nanjing, petty theft was the norm among students, a way of life that started with a simple carrot pilfered from the kitchen. In state shops and department stores, clerks at the counter subtly doctored receipts or even produced counterfeits, while in the back assistants rummaged through the storage rooms. Su Qishu, a sales assistant at the Friendship store in Shanghai, tampered with receipts, adding small sums of money that amounted over time to around 300 yuan. Li Shandi, employed in a pharmacy, confessed to putting away 1 yuan each day over several years, almost doubling her salary. Opportunity was greatest in the city, but need ruled the countryside, where many farmers had to survive famine by living on their wits. At every stage of the production cycle, villagers tried to keep back some of the grain from the demands of the state. This started in the field, even before the wheat or maize was fully ripened. Harking back to a traditional practice called qiqing, or eating green, villagers quietly clipped off spikes of grain straight from the field, husked and ground it in their hands, and ate the raw green kernels when out of sight of the militia. Eating the crop before it reached maturity was more common in the north, as it was easier to hide among dense rows of maize or in a field thick with wheat than in a rice paddy. Maize was also a more durable crop, standing in the fields for a longer period of time, and thus allowing for a greater number of thefts to take place. The autumn harvest in 1960 almost vanished in some communes as a result of crop eating. In Guangrao, Shandong province, several brigades took up to 80% of the maize before it ripened, while crops of millet and green beans vanished altogether. In Xiaoxian County, also in Shandong, up to 90% of all grains disappeared. Thousands of similar incidents rocked the province, as many of those discovered eating from the fields were beaten to death by the local militia. In Xuancheng, Anhui, entire fields were eaten clean, as if a swarm of locusts had passed over them. Recollecting the years of hunger, farmer Zhong Mu captured the importance of theft. Those who could not steal died. Those who managed to steal some food did not die. Once the grain had been threshed and bagged, it was bulked up with water and sold to the state, with or without the complicity of local inspectors. As we have already seen, in Guangdong alone, almost a third of 1.5 million tons of state grain suffered from a high water content, although poor storage conditions no doubt contributed to the rot in the subtropical south. Once sold to the state, grain on the move was exposed to a plethora of thieving hands. In Xingxing County, Guangdong, close to 900 incidents of theft were reported in 1960. Lin Si, a boatman from Xinhe, took about half a ton of grain on dozens of occasions. Others were more prudent, replacing stolen foodstuffs with sand and stones. In Guangzhou, shippers would extract the grain with a bamboo tube and pour sand back into the bags. In Gaoyao, Jiangsu, just about every boatman helped himself to the grain, each taking an average of 300 kilos a year. Guards in charge of state granaries stole. In Jiangxiaoku, bordering Hebei and Inner Mongolia, a fifth of all watchmen were dishonest, sometimes stealing with the complicity of party members. Half of all carders in charge of collection points in Siuxian County were corrupt. In the end, with the grain passing through so many grasping hands, one wonders how much actually reached the canteen table. In Suzhou, local investigators estimated that out of a kilo of rice, only about half made it to its final destination. It was pilfered from the granaries, taken during transportation, pocketed by accountants, confiscated by carders, and finally filched by cooks before a bowl of rice was ever served in a canteen. When local carders colluded with the farmers, powerful forms of collective theft, subterfuge, and deception could emerge, shielding the village from the worst effects of the famine. Some carders kept two sets of books, one with the real figures in the village and another with fake numbers for the eyes of grain inspectors. This was widespread in several counties in Guangdong province. In Suannun County, Hubei, one in three bookkeepers falsified the accounts. In Chongyang County, one party secretary took the initiative by declaring some 250 tons to the commune higher up, but penciling 315 tons into the local account book. In June 1959, the office of the Hebei Provincial Committee concluded from a discrepancy between the amount of grain actually stored and the official inventory that 160,000 tons were missing, much of it as a consequence of false reporting and creative accounting. Then the grain had to be hidden, which was no easy task in the midst of ferocious and often bloody campaigns to take it from the farmers. In Xiaogan, Hubei, one of the largest stashes discovered by inspection teams contained some 60 tons of grain. In Yitang commune, 110 tons were hidden behind false walls, inside coffins, or in wardrobes. A search in Wulwo, among 15 households, yielded 26 tons. In some cases, local leaders distributed the grain immediately after the harvest and urged farmers to eat as much as they could before the militia could strike. Throughout the country, there were cases of local leaders quietly distributing grain to the farmers, helping many to survive the famine. In Yixian County, Hebei, 150 to 200 kilos of harvested grain per hectare were handed out in one commune. Elsewhere, inspection teams commonly found black granaries. In Jiaohe County, virtually every team had underground grain of around 750 kilos. Near Tianjin, the leader of Sunxi Commune put it in simple terms when he withheld 200 tons of seed. The state's grain is also the people's grain, and what belongs to the people also belongs to the state. In Hunan, some 23 counties were discovered to have 5 to 10% of grain above what had been declared, totaling 36,000 tons. One of the most extreme cases was Liuyang, where 7,500 tons turned up after a painstaking check of 30,000 granaries. But all too often the reverse was true. In many villages, local leaders preferred to lower the grain consumption rather than ask for help higher up the chain of command, as they feared being seen as slackers who would beg rather than work towards a higher crop. Another stratagem used by local carders was to borrow grain from state granaries. In Hebei, some 357,000 tons were thus borrowed up to April 1959, often under pressure from highly placed party members. Party secretary Li Xiangzhong from Sunggu commune near Tianjin thus phoned the granary for a loan, which the employees flatly refused, only to be visited by the local boss who exerted the power of his position. When you are asked for a loan, you should lend. Even when you are not asked for a loan, you should lend. From now on, if there is a problem, I will come and sort it out. A loan of 35 tons was agreed on the spot. Units and institutions in cities, too, were keen to borrow without ever paying back. One middle school borrowed grain to feed its students, incurring a debt of 35,000 yuan. But in the end, when the food ran out, people turned on each other, stealing from other villages, neighbours, or even relatives. In Nanjing, half of all conflicts between neighbors involved food, as people stole from each other, some of the incidents leading to fistfights. Children and the elderly suffered most. For instance, when a blind grandmother was robbed of the little rice she had been able to buy with relief coupons in Danyang City. In the countryside, fierce competition for survival gradually eroded any sense of social cohesion. In Liaotia village, just outside Changsha, larceny was so bad that desperate carders could do nothing but tell the farmers to steal from other villages instead, for which they would not be punished. And once community bonds in the countryside unraveled, the family became an arena for strife, jealousy, and conflict. One woman remembered how her mother-in-law slept with food coupons in a pouch tied around her neck. A nephew cut the string and stole the coupons one cold winter night, exchanging the lot for sweets. The woman died several days later. Communes, villages, families, all were seething with tension and resentment, as famine increasingly pitted erstwhile neighbors, friends, and relatives against each other. As one party official noted in Hubei during the distribution of the summer crop, between the state and collectives, between brigades, between individuals, up, down, left, right, and center, at all levels there are disputes. Violence flared, fights over the crop tearing apart units or teams. Sticks and knives were produced as villagers confronted each other in fights over food. In Yingshan County, Hubei, two poor men were hung from a tree after they were found stealing millet. In times of famine, one person's gain was another's loss. Even when it seemed that petty theft took place against a faceless state, somebody down the chain of distribution paid the price. In Xuanwei County, Yunnan, a number of village leaders pumped up the figures when making grain deliveries in December 1958. The grain was earmarked to feed 80,000 railway workers. The plan on paper had penciled in enough calories for each worker, but it failed to predict that the amounts delivered by the neighboring villages were below the planned requirements. The railway workers, ordinary farmers conscripted from the countryside, went hungry for several days, and some 70 died of hunger before the end of the month. Throughout the countryside, radical collectivization created conditions of extreme shortage in which one person's survival depended on another person's starvation. In the end, through a combination of destructive policies initiated from above and covert forms of self-help pursued from below, the country imploded. But while self-defense and self-destruction in the famished countryside were often hard to disentangle, it was the weak, vulnerable and poor, who suffered the most. Chapter 25. Dear Chairman Mao. Truth had met its end in Lushan. Although speaking out is never advisable in a one-party state, the clash among leaders in the summer of 1959 left nobody in any doubt about the danger of offering an opinion that diverged from the party line. And as Mao was often cryptic in his pronouncements, it was prudent to veer to the left rather than stray to the right. In the midst of mass starvation, nobody actually mentioned famine, as leaders used euphemisms such as natural disasters or temporary difficulties. Lower down the ladder, famine was such a taboo that local carders went to great lengths to hide the starving and the sick from the prying eyes of inspection teams. When the party committee of Longhua County, Hebei, sent a group of officials to investigate the countryside, some villages herded the sick together and hid them in the mountains. A string of foreign visitors, carefully screened by the party and given a lavish tour of model communes, were all too willing to jump to the defense of Maoism. François Mitterrand, a left-wing politician who later became president of France, felt privileged to report the chairman's words of wisdom to the West. In his opulent villa in Hangzhou, Mao, a great scholar known in the entire world for the diversity of his genius, told him in 1961 that there was no famine, but only a period of scarcity. At the other end of the political spectrum, the Englishman John Temple, Conservative MP for Chester, toured the country in late 1960 and declared that communism worked and the country was making great progress. But not everybody was so willing to be duped. Foreign students with a Chinese background were far less gullible. The majority of the 1,500 foreign students in Nanjing, most from Indonesia, others from Thailand, Malaysia, and Vietnam, expressed doubts about the Great Leap Forward, openly wondering about the viability of the communes and questioning the whole idea of collectivization. As early as March 1959, quite a few were acutely aware of the effects of hunger on the countryside. Some foreign students were less inhibited than their local counterparts, but critical views were widespread in schools around the country, despite repeated campaigns against rightist conservatism. As an investigation team dispatched by the Communist Youth League found, misgivings about the Great Leap Forward, the Communist Party, and socialism in general were common. University students openly asked why, if the people's communes were such a superior form of organization, food was short and peasants were abandoning their villages. Why was the supply of goods so poor in a socialist system? Why was the standard of living so low if the rate of development was higher than in capitalist countries? Indonesia may be a colony, but people there live a good life, one student opined. In the cities, talk about the famine was muffled by the roar of propaganda, but was clearly audible to the many agents of the party. As informers working for a street committee noted in the Putuo district of Shanghai, ordinary factory workers, like Chun Ruhang, speculated openly about the number of deaths caused by the famine. Mass starvation was the main topic of conversation in his household, with visitors coming from the famished countryside in 1961. In Hubei, as the Federation of Trade Unions discovered, half of all workers were talking critically about the famine by the end of 1961. Some openly defied their leaders. In one case, a man who was reprimanded for shirking work patted his stomach, then looked the carder right in the eye and said, "It's empty." In the south, closer to Hong Kong and Macau, talk about the free world beckoning just across the border was common by 1962. In Zhongshan County, young people tilling the fields swapped stories about the Crown Colony, and hundreds actually attempted to make the passage each year. Many were arrested and sent back to their villages, where they regaled their friends with tales from their odyssey. In Guangzhou, young workers openly admired Hong Kong, allowing flights of fancy to take them to a mythical place where the food was bountiful and the work was easy. "Hong Kong is a good world," somebody scribbled on the wall of a primary school. Other scribblers appeared determined to leave behind more permanent traces of their discontent. Messages of opposition were scrawled on toilet walls. In Xinying City, one angry hand etched a slogan in a public toilet insulting Mao. A lengthy diatribe against the export of food was found on the wall of a toilet in the Nanjing automobile factory. More daring were those who came out at night to post flyers and posters critical of the party. In Shanghai, somebody left a 2-meter poster inciting rebellion. Sometimes hundreds of leaflets were involved. In Gaoyang, 100 flyers with handwritten slogans on pink or red paper appeared overnight, prominently posted on walls or pinned on trees around the city. "Why are the people of our country starving?" "Because all the grain is being shipped to the Soviet Union." Another sounded a warning. "The harvest is coming up soon, and we must organize a movement to steal the wheat. He who wishes to join in, please be prepared." In Lanzhou, over 2,700 flyers advocated a general strike in May 1962. In Hainan, the large island off the coast of Guangdong, some 40,000 anti-party leaflets were reportedly distributed, some apparently dropped from planes sent by Chiang Kai-shek. The extent of these subversive activities is difficult to gauge, as traces of opposition must have been erased as soon as they were spotted. But in Nanjing, in a mere 3 months, some 40 separate slogans and flyers about the famine were reported by the police. Farmers, too, used posters to seek redress, vent their anger, or denounce cicada. In Ningjin County, Hebei, Chang Xirong was brave enough to post a long wall essay called a Dajibao in protest over the conditions of his local canteen. He immediately attracted the attention of the local public security bureau and was dragged away. His plea, in any event, was a lonely one, lost in a sea of 1.7 million flyers, posters and slogans the county deployed in its campaign to heighten public security. Just as stubborn was farmer Wang Yutang. His response to an anti-rightist campaign, with its millions of official propaganda posters and ceaseless radio broadcasts, was to post his own Dajibao in Xishu County. The Great Leap Forward in 1958 was all bragging. "Workers suffer greatly and our stomachs go hungry," it boldly proclaimed. But even if the balance of power was heavily tilted towards the party, which used a sea of propaganda to drown out the slightest grumbling of discontent, posters could sometimes achieve their goal. In Dazhou County, Sichuan, villagers effectively turned some of the propaganda weapons of the party against a local leader, denouncing him in more than 20 posters for embezzling 6 yuan. The public humiliation was such that the man refused to oversee the harvest and went fishing instead. Farmers immediately took possession of the crop. But more popular were verses. Just as Mao had demanded that everyone be a soldier, he proclaimed every man and woman a poet. The population was forced to produce millions of verses in the autumn of 1958, as festivals were organized and prizes handed out for the best folk songs that rhapsodized bumper harvests, steel plants, or water conservancy measures. A frenzied vision of a socialist future was conjured up in rhymed quatrains churned out by the million. In Shanghai alone, it was claimed that a mere 200,000 workers had composed some 5 million poems. While much of the officially sponsored poetry was rather trite, a truly creative spirit did appear in some of the ditties spontaneously created by villagers in response to collectivization. Here in the midst of famine was a playful sense of humor that helped people get through times of misery. In Shanghai, a popular saying was, "All is well under Chairman Mao, a shame no one can eat his fill." In Xiangmen County, Guangdong, farmers sang the following song. "Collectivization, collectivization, nobody earns, somebody spends. Members earn, but teams spend. Teams earn, but brigades spend. Brigades earn, but communes spend. Only fools become party activists." An illiterate villager came up with a poem to describe the thin gruel served in the canteen. "We enter the canteen, we see a big pot of gruel. Waves swell on each side of the pot, in the middle people drown." Local carders were given satirical nicknames that mocked their greed, bad temper or gluttony. In Kaiping County, Guangdong, farmers referred to one particularly rotund carder as cooked food dog, Yan Huo Go. Golden fly and chopping block aunt were also used. Elsewhere, big belly was common, while every commune seemed to have a demon from the ghostly underworld. Many a carder was called King Yan, the king of hell. Irony was not uncommon. In Sichuan, where, as we have seen, provincial leader Li Jianquan noted how people became even more corpulent than Mao Zedong thanks to the bounty brought about by collectivization, some of the villagers mocked the canteens, saying that the advantage of the mess hall is that we are all much fatter, referring to the swelling of bodies in famine edema. Just beneath the surface of official propaganda lay a shadow world of rumours,